lights out on the hour. It is the hour of the time. Lights out for the curfew of your body, soul, and mind.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. Now, tonight will be part one in a very special series that will help you tie a lot of history to modern-day events. But first, the contact information. If you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOTT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. My personal email address is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. The studio number, 928-333-2942. And the studio in Canada, 613-733-4324. And that's Robert Houghton, the co-host. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this evening we're going to start a series on the PSYOPs of the Strategic Hamlet. Now, many of you may have never heard of this, but stay tuned to this entire series to get an idea of the history behind the concept of the Strategic Hamlet from Vietnam and pre-Vietnam to today. And then I'm going to lead you all the way in this series to the Helmand Valley of Afghanistan, the PSYOPs of the Strategic Hamlet, starting in Vietnam. Also like to take a quick break here to thank Sergeant Major Herbert for his work and aid and study in this field and area and endeavor. And also I will be giving a bibliography throughout the broadcast. Thank you. again. You're listening to the Hour of the Time this evening and part one in a new series of broadcasts on the Strategic Hamlet concept and the PsyOps involving it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when the British fought the insurgency led by Chinese communists in Malaya in 1948 to 1960, one of their weapons was to place the Malayans in fortified villages that could be guarded around the clock and thus separate the people from the guerrillas in the jungle. That was one very successful way to fight Mao Zedong's concept that the guerrilla must move amongst the people as a fish swims in the sea. Under the direction of the retired Lieutenant General Sir Harold Briggs, the shortcomings of the government were identified. These included the lack of population control measures. Population control measures. From these considerations, the Briggs Plan was formulated. The guerrillas would first be separated from the civilian population that sustained them, and then defeated through coordinated civil, military, and police action. The first part of the Briggs Plan called for the large-scale resettlement of about 500,000 squatters in the jungle fringes to new villages. These subsistence farmers were the main source of food for the rebel army. Starting in June 1950, this program resettled 423,000 Chinese squatters in 410 new villages by 1952. These new villages had a defense perimeter to ensure controlled entry and exit. The government gave every family 5 months worth of provisions and all the materials needed to build a house. This gave the squatters an immediate sense of ownership. The communists were now forced to come out of the jungle and into the open to search for food. It made them vulnerable to attack and ambush. Then, in 1951, the British introduced the food denial program called Operation Starvation. This program was designed to stop the smuggling of excess food to the communists. The measures included ration reduction, punching holes in canned food at the time of purchase, strict checks by the guards on all personnel moving in and out of the villages, and forbidding meals from being brought to work areas. Communal cooking of rice was encouraged to prevent any private ownership of uncooked rice that might be smuggled to the communists. The guerrillas were now forced to come further out of the jungle to meet their suppliers who could be identified, turned, and used as a source to set up additional ambushes. I would like you, ladies and gentlemen, to write down this book title. Author Andrew R. Molnar, spelled M-O-L-N-A-R. Phonetically, Mike, Oscar, Lima, November, Alpha, Romeo. Human Factors, Considerations of Undergrounds and Insurgencies. A very important book, ladies and gentlemen. Human Factors, Considerations of Undergrounds and Insurgencies. During the Vietnam War, the Republic of Vietnam had the same problem. Large numbers of communist Viet Cong were able to enter villages and take food, either voluntarily or as a tax by armed collectors. Midshipman Jason Thomas Chaput defines the Hamlet problem in his 2000 thesis, The Chin Hoi Program and the Perceptions of Reality. Quote, during the 1960s, the political and military cadres orchestrated a mass seizure of hamlets from the government of Vietnam across the country. Hamlets were clusters of homes where several hamlets constituted a village. With the aid of superior intelligence gathering and lethal tactics such as abductions, forced indoctrinations, and even executions, the Viet Cong removed any obstacles presented by the supporters of the government of Vietnam in the hamlets. In the battle for the hamlets, the use of ambushes and the destruction of vital bridges and roads by the Viet Cong effectively cut off the government of Vietnam and its military forces from many villages. Once the government of Vietnam abandoned a village, the population gave up hope of overcoming the communists, and the VC needed only to execute a few important villagers to win the individual hamlets. By organizing large political groups in the villages, the cadres succeeded in getting thousands of young males per month to join the local Vietnam guerrilla forces. End quote. Using the British tactics and in some cases British advisors, Vietnam President Diem first implemented a rural community development program in 1959, also called Agroville. Through direct force and/or incentives, peasants and rural communities were separated and relocated into large communities called Agrovilles. By 1960, there were 23 of these Agrovilles, each consisting of many thousands of people. Kevin Ruan says, in the Vietnam Wars by Manchester University Press, quote, a precursor to notorious strategic hamlets, the so-called Agroville program began in 1958 and 1959. It was designed to relocate the peasantry in area where the army could protect them from Viet Cong terror and propaganda, and the Saigon government sought to make it attractive by providing the new communities with schools, medical facilities, and electricity. But the peasants deeply resented being forcibly removed from their homes and from the lands which contained the sacred bones of their ancestors. The Agroville program was eventually abandoned, but only after it had spawned tremendous rural discontent with the government. End quote. Now another book for you to write down, ladies and gentlemen, Seth Jacobs, author Seth Jacobs, Cold War Mandarin, Go Dinh Diem and the Origins of America's War in Vietnam, 1950 to 1963. And a quote from Mr. Jacobs, Diem's insistence that the peasants build the Agrovilles themselves, enforced labor gangs no less, and without compensation, did nothing to improve his reputation in South Vietnam. But even more counterproductive was the fact that the peasants grouped into Agrovilles had to abandon their ancestral lands. In a culture like Vietnam's, where people were deeply attached to home and village, such uprooting was traumatic, and many South Vietnamese resented it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there were many leaflets like Leaflet 246-54-67 to encourage Vietnamese civilians to move to the strategic hamlets. This particular leaflet depicts their old village occupied by Viet Cong and bombed, while their new hamlet is safe and protected by the Army of Vietnam. And as a matter of fact, the 246th PSYOP Company disseminated by aircraft over 100,000 of these leaflets. And on the reverse side of the leaflet, it says, quote, to protect your lives and properties, you must move immediately and resettle in new life hamlets in the secure area of Binh Cao, Can Gang, and Binh Cao. Your present hamlets will be bombed and fired on every night to destroy Viet Cong installations in your area. The government of Vietnam regrets that you have to leave your rice fields and gardens. Therefore, you will be allowed, if requests are submitted to the district chief, to return to your homes and work on your rice fields and gardens, take care of your property, and return to the new location at night. End quote. Another book by Stanley Carnell, that Stanley Carnell devotes 7 pages to the Strategic Hamlet Program. The book is entitled Vietnam, A History. It's by Out of the Viking Press in New York, 1983. None of his comments, of course, are complimentary, and almost all of them echo the same complaints, ladies and gentlemen, heard from other critics. Some of Mr. Carnell's comments on the Agraville program are, quote, another blunder at the time was the creation of the accoutrement known as Agravilles, farm communities designed mainly to isolate the rural population from the communists. The Agraville near Vieth Anh looked magnificent. Flanking a canal, it was enclosed by a bamboo fence and neat rows of thatched roof hits that had been laid out. Its director showed me the school dispensary and power plant. He boasted that he had completed the project in 50 days on Diem's personal instructions. In reality, it was a disaster. Peasants assigned to the Agraville had been uprooted from their native villages and ancestral graves, and their traditional social pattern disrupted for reasons they could not fathom. Worse still, 20,000 peasants were mobilized to construct a project that could only hold 6,000. Thus, 14,000 men and women had been compelled to abandon their crops and work without pay for others. End quote. Ladies and gentlemen, we should take a moment to mention Vietnam's first president, Go Dinh Diem. He authorized the Strategic Hamlet Program and took much of the blame for its failure, although it is doubtful that anyone could have made it work in a country where the land is sacred and removing one from it, even for the best reasons, is bound to cause controversy. He was attacked for nepotism and his administration for corruption. Certainly there was corruption. But there were also the constant verbal and written attacks from North Vietnam and the communist bloc nations, so it is difficult to say what was real and what was propaganda. He was attacked for his pro-Catholic beliefs in a nation that was largely Buddhist. The government was regarded as being biased towards Catholics in public service and military promotions, as well as the allocation of land, business favors, and tax concessions. And another problem that will seem strange considering that North Vietnam called Diem an American lackey was that he simply would not take orders from his American advisors. They wanted him to act a certain way and to fight the war in an approved American manner. He wanted to do it his way. Much of the problem might have been caused by his fear of a coup and his desire to keep the generals weak and divided. But the result was that he nourished the very coup d'etat that he fought on a daily basis. He thought that the generals were out to get him, and he was right. Diem's reputation eventually was tarnished enough that the United States washed its hands of him, although there was no smoking gun to show that the U.S. agency took part in his overthrow and murder, there is reason to believe that the Vietnamese generals were assured that American funds would not be cut if he was murdered. On the 1st of November, 1963, Diem was overthrown and the generals told him he could leave the country safely to live in exile. Instead, they murdered him. Diem had been a strong anti-communist, and Ho Chi Minh allegedly said, when hearing of the coup, quote, "I can sincerely believe the Americans would be so stupid." Gentlemen, you're listening to the Hour of the Time here with your host, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. Now, before we continue on with this first broadcast in a series on strategic hamlets and the psychological operations involved, a few quick reminders. If you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time or HOTT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And the studio number, 928-333-2942. And the Canadian studio to co-host Robert Houghton, 613-733-4324. Now, ladies and gentlemen, also don't forget we are listener-supported, and through your support, with your donations for broadcast, DVD productions, we can continue to expand our research base, offer the archives that take production time and man-hours and equipment and supplies, and all of our operations here at Hour of the Time. Also, ladies and gentlemen, please don't forget about the Pennsylvania Conference. We had two more people sign up just today. Go to the website, hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com to get all the details for the Pennsylvania Conference 2010. That's in April in Pennsylvania, the Hour of the Time Skills and Research Conference. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in case you don't know your history very well, either because of the public school system or age or just you haven't read much, I want to recap slightly into what we were discussing before the musical break. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, the North Vietnam called President Diem of South Vietnam an American lackey. But he would not take any orders from American advisors. They wanted him to act in a certain way or fight the war in an approved American manner. He wanted to do it his way. Much of his problems have been caused by his fear of a coup and his desire to keep the generals weak and divided. But the result was that he nourished the very coup d'etat that he fought on a daily basis. He thought that the generals were out to get him, and he was right. Diem's reputation eventually was tarnished enough that the United States washed its hands of him. And although there is no smoking gun to show that any U.S. agency took part in his overthrow and murder, there is reason to believe that the Vietnamese generals were assured that American funds would not be cut off if he was murdered. And on the 1st of November 1963, Diem was overthrown, and the generals told him he could leave the country safely to live in exile. Instead, they murdered him. Diem had been a strong anti-communist, and Ho Chi Minh allegedly said when hearing of the coup, "I can scarcely believe the Americans would be so stupid." Well, the North Vietnamese Politburo was even more surprised. Quote, "The consequences of the 1st of November coup d'etat will be contrary to the calculations of the U.S. imperialist. Diem was one of the strongest individuals resisting the people and communism. Everything that could be done in an attempt to crush the revolution was carried out by Diem. Diem was one of the most competent lackeys of the U.S. imperialist. The coup d'etat on 1st November 1963 will not be the last." An independent researcher, ladies and gentlemen, and author, Nguyen Cai Phong, said this about Diem. Quote, "Diem was not the best, but he was much better than his predecessors, especially Emperor Bao Dai. He also stood out among his contemporaries as an incorruptible, unapproachable anti-French patriot. His accession to power was neither based on his relation with the colonists or any power, at least before he was appointed prime minister by Bao Dai, with American and French consent. Why many Vietnamese national leaders indulged in the privileges that accompanied their positions, President Diem did not. He lived a life of an ascetic. He did have weaknesses, however. His dependency on his brothers and parochial and religious associates was too great to allow him to make an independent and realistic assessment of the actual situation in Vietnam. He traveled from time to time to visit with his subjects, but some believe that the people he met were told what to say and how to act. There were reports that his three brothers used his name to build financial and political influence for themselves. Governmental and civil service procedures were not followed or enforced by the president, which caused grave discontent and distrust within the rank and file of civil servants. Certain military officers were promoted due to their wealth, family, or connection with the president's staff or family. The position of Secretary of Defense was not filled until the final days of the regime. The position of presidential advisor was delegated to the president's brother without the consent or advice of the Senate or any authoritative government agency. During the length of his presidency, Diem was unable to fend off accusations of nepotism, cronyism, and favoritism. The question of what might have happened if President Diem was left in power is difficult to answer. There were two earlier attempts to overthrow Diem. The abortive November 1960 coup d'etat should have been a warning to him, but he failed to react or order any reform to appease the opposition. Could the Diem regime have survived had the United States not acquiesced to a coup to replace him? Would he eventually have changed his course, replaced his many yes men, and overhauled his entire administration? And even if he were to do all that, would South Vietnam have survived the relentless and determined attacks from the communist North? Diem was not allowed to live, so we will never know what might have happened. End quote. Mr. John R. Campbell, who was a civilian psychological warfare advisor in Vietnam from 1965 to 1967, mentions Diem and the strategic hamlets briefly in Are We Winning? Are They Winning? A Civilian Advisor's Reflections on Wartime Vietnam. Again, author John R. Campbell. Author House from 2004. The title, Are We Winning? Are They Winning? A Civilian Advisor's Reflections on Wartime Vietnam. And a quote from Mr. Campbell, an early attempt was made to emulate the British experience and success of Malayan post-World War II communist insurgency. This was the forced transfer of scattered populations into fortified villages called strategic hamlets, where passage in and out was controlled. This was making some positive headway under the firm dictatorial hand of President Diem, but it was allowed to lapse even before his abrupt and violent departure from the scene in 1963. The political wisdom of the early 60s was that the fortified village plan was too oppressive and prison-like for acceptance by the general public in Vietnam or in America. In retrospect, they would have been doing both themselves and the rural population a favor to have them just grumbling at the protectors rather than shooting at each other, as turned out to be the alternative. End quote. After Diem, there was a parade of leaders none as strong or as able to lead the nation in its war against the communist. He is still reviled in the press to this day, but many Vietnamese believe he was the only man that could have led the country to ultimate victory against the North Vietnamese. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to go in and cover some of the leaflets that were spread and disseminated via aircraft and operatives in the field from psychological warfare units. For instance, one leaflet was prepared to convince the people that leaving their home village were a worthwhile action. On the front of the leaflet, two farmers are cutting wood to build a house. And the text says, we would rather leave our birthplace than live under the communists. And on the back, in part, the leaflet said, the slogan speaks for itself. The people would rather leave their birthplace and live in freedom rather than under communist rule. The government of Vietnam is helping the refugees in My Ca to build their new homes and start life again in freedom. This mass resettlement, ladies and gentlemen, created a strong backlash from peasants and forced the central government to rethink its strategy. In fact, one critical report stated, quote, tens of thousands of people are being mobilized to take up a life in collectivity to construct beautiful but useless agrovilles which tire the people, lose their affection, increase their resentment, and most of all, give an additional terrain for propaganda to the enemy, end quote. Ladies and gentlemen, there's also even a song entitled Let Us Build Up the New Hamlets. This marching song was designed to inspire the rural development cadre to develop the hamlets as a means of serving the people and help in transforming the nation. It was printed by JustPal. And if you're not familiar with that, it's the Joint U.S. Public Affairs Office. Let Us Build Up the New Hamlets is what it's called. Then, in 1961, the government of South Vietnam, along with several U.S. advisors and the head of the British Advisory Mission to South Vietnam, Sir Robert Thompson, began reforming the Agroville Plan into what was to become the Strategic Hamlet Program, later revitalized as the New Life Hamlet, and finally revised into the Secure Hamlet. The new plan called for smaller communities, less than 1,000 residents, erected on both existing and newly developed settlements. The government of South Vietnam wanted to create a new infrastructure with the intention that the Vietnamese peasants would come to identify Diem and his regime as the legitimate government. If you look, Thomas Ahearn had a Declassified Secret Center for the Study of Intelligence publication. Declassified Secret Center for the Study of Intelligence publication entitled CIA and the Rural Pacification in South Vietnam by Thomas Ahearn. Ahearn says, quote, by the end of 1961, Diem acquired a foreign counterinsurgency advisor of his own, Sir Robert G.K. Thompson, who had participated in the British campaign against the Chinese communist insurgents in Malaya. Thompson called first for the eradication of the insurgents, then for social and economic improvements to consolidate the improved morale he expected this to evoke. New and Colby, yes, that's Colby of the CIA, ladies and gentlemen, continuing to affirm the Strategic Hamlet's essentially political core, accepted Thompson's order of priorities, in which the completion of security arrangements, moats, perimeter fences, a militia, etc., preceded political reforms and economic development. Except where the government of South Vietnam could quarantine the population with a barrier of troops, the success of this approach depended on the active participation of villagers who shared the perception of the communist as an oppressive alien presence. The difficulty was that many villagers had from childhood viewed things through the prism of Viet Cong ideas, beliefs, and prejudices. Indeed, there were families that had supported Viet Minh and its successors for three generations. The only direct CIA support to Strategic Hamlets came in the form of training and weapons for some of Ngo Dinh Nhu's Republican youth, who were used to bolster Hamlet defense, as of November 1962, 1,625 such cadres had been issued weapons upon completion of what the station called advanced training. No reporting on the deployment or subsequent service has been found. End quote, ladies and gentlemen. Now, to take from Why Did the Strategic Hamlet Program Fail? Written by Lieutenant Colonel Peter Francis Leahy. Again, Why Did the Strategic Hamlet Program Fail? By Lieutenant Colonel Peter Francis Leahy. Quote, by mid-1961, South Vietnam had already started strategic hamlets, and the government had some experience with pacification through the Agroville scheme. But as Diem struggled with the problems of insurgency, he turned to other countries in an attempt both to learn from their experience and, more particularly, to gain moral, material, and financial support. Diem sought advice and assistance from both the Philippines and Malaya, as well as from the countries that had supported them. This included British advisors from Malaya and U.S. advisors from the Philippines. Although the experiences in Malaya and the Philippines were unique, there were many similarities with the situation in the Republic of Vietnam. Both Malaya and the Philippines used pacification as a major component of their strategy to defeat the insurgencies. As Diem considered his options, it was natural that he should look at these experiences. Now, ladies and gentlemen, another leaflet, number 3062, shows a new housing area open to Vietnamese citizens, much like row and barracks and apartment buildings with neatly thatched roofs, utilities, water, power lines, and poles. The front of the leaflet said, "The government of Vietnam builds, the communists destroy." The back of the leaflet, all text as the previous leaflet, says in part, "To build for the people." The government has built an extremely good compound which includes more than 1,500 apartments with all the conveniences like electricity and running water. The housing compound has a school, kindergarten, hospital, and several administrative buildings. This undertaking shows the real concern of the government of Vietnam for the poor citizen and its continual efforts in raising the standards of life of the people. End quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, by 1962, the general plan was to build 11,000 to 12,000 hamlets, enough to shelter the entire population. The plan, ladies and gentlemen, was to build 11,000 to 12,000 hamlets, enough to shelter the entire population. 7,000 hamlets would be completed in 1962, the remainder to be ready for occupation by early 1964. In late 1962, President Diem stated that 7,267,517 people lived in strategic hamlets. These numbers, however, do not correspond with any figures provided by the Allies and probably were exaggerations forwarded to the President by his aides. And, ladies and gentlemen, if you look to what I suggest you go find, Strategic Hamlets, American State Department, 1963, you'll find in there the aims and objectives of the Strategic Hamlet Program. Quote, is to achieve the widest possible popular response to the government's counterinsurgency effort by providing the peasants with an increasing degree of physical security from communist intimidation by enacting social, economic, and political reforms meaningful to the peasants in the context of their own traditions and expectations. It should be noted, in a country such as Vietnam, which has emerged only recently from almost 100 years of colonial rule, and where popular concepts of government have been locally rather than nationally oriented, the very fact that the national government would seek to serve and protect the citizenry might itself be considered revolutionary. The immediate security objectives of the program are twofold. First, to sever communist communication and control lines to the rural populace and thus deny the communist the local resources, manpower, food, intelligence, and weapons necessary to their operations. Secondly, to promote a nationwide self-defense effort at the rice roots level by providing the peasants with weapons and other defense facilities. The document, again, I suggest you get it, Strategic Hamlets, American State Department, 1963, goes on to say, the strategic hamlet is essentially a fortified hamlet. A fence of bamboo and barbed wire is built around the entire hamlet, and a ditch or moat is dug around the fence. The ditch or moat, in turn, is encircled by an earthen mound. The area around the village is cleared to permit fields of fire and to avoid giving guerrillas and terrorists hiding places close to the hamlet. Inside the strategic hamlet, there are one or more observation towers, guard posts, and a defense post for the storage of arms. An alarm system, either of the most rudimentary type, for instance a bell, gong, or bamboo drum, or a field telephone, alerts the community to communist attacks. And, ladies and gentlemen, if you go to the research study series, look for the publication entitled The United States Air Force in Southeast Asia. Quoting from that, two types of strategic hamlets were planned. One, designed for use in areas dominated by guerrillas, called for physical relocation of the population to well-secured areas, surrounded by a wide ditch, a mud embankment, with bamboo spikes and barbed wire. These hamlets differed from the agrovilles both by housing fewer people and by being situated closer to the rice fields. This type went into operation in Binh Duong and in the Delta. The other type, for use in more secure regions, was built by simply enlarging and fortifying already existing villages. Some thinly inhabited sections would have no strategic villages at all, but would be shielded only by militia stationed in strategically located stone watchtowers. Now back to Lieutenant Colonel Peter Francis Leahy. From Why Did the Strategic Hamlet Program Fail? Quote, the first type was the heavily fortified hamlets found in the contested areas around Saigon. In these hamlets, much of the area was surrounded by extensive earthworks, including a ditch about 5 feet deep and a rampart 10 feet wide at the top. Both the ditch and rampart were studded with bamboo spears. Outside the ditch, there were generally a fence of bamboo, wooden pickets, thorn hedges, or barbed wire. In the second type, observed in Vinh Long Province, which had less of a security problem. The hamlets were divided into defensive blocks, which comprised most of the residential areas. These blocks were afforded defense by bamboo spears embedded in the ground, thorn hedges, portable steel spike boards, and a few hand grenades planted as landmines. The third type observed in Kin Hao province was the least heavily defended. In these, the fortifications and defensive devices were usually limited to the military post. End quote. In all the comments, ladies and gentlemen, about the strategic hamlets, a common thread is that the people must be trained to protect themselves and their hamlets so the army can get about its business of fighting the communist. Leaflet 3781 depicted members of the trained civil self-defense forces. On the front, armed members are depicted on patrol. And on the back, they march in a parade. Part of the text says, civil self-defense forces. As of now, 3 million people have participated in the civil self-defense forces throughout the country. Among them, 1.5 million members have received training and have been armed with weapons. In 1970, over 40,000 more will be armed. This is an effective force to defend the security of villages and hamlets and is rated to crush every terrorist attack to the communists to ensure a peaceful life for the people. End quote. Another leaflet, ladies and gentlemen, depicts a number of Vietnamese men who have joined the popular forces to defend the hamlets and the nation. The text on the front says, it is everybody's responsibility to protect the nation. On the back, the text discusses some of the purposes of the People's Self-Defense Plan. The text says, in part, A, to mobilize the entire population for participation in the war. B, to create a force to defend our villages and cities in order to increase the availability of troops to the armed forces at the front. C, to unify the people's will to defend the national righteous cause in the political struggle against the enemy. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, as an aside, the national righteous cause is an official term used at the time. D, to create a popular force which supports the voices of the nation at the international conference table. E, to support every aspect of an all-out long and difficult war in order to advance towards self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and self-determination. F, to make general mobilization a reasonable policy by utilizing the national potential equally in all fields of activity. This will permit the fighting to be carried on without impeding national production, because the rear echelons are actively supporting the fighting men. Let us join together to protect the nation. End text. Leahy states that in the early 1960s, ladies and gentlemen, the Self-Defense Corps numbered about 60,000 and provided the military basis of the strategic hamlet system. The Corps was responsible for security within the hamlet and the areas immediately around it. They performed tasks such as guarding public buildings and bridges, escorting village officials in unsafe areas, and patrolling the village area. Ladies and gentlemen, I think you get the gist of this series. Thank you for listening to the Hour of the Time. Your host here, Doyle Shamley. Website, hourofthetime.com. And be sure to tune in to thehourofthetime.com for more exciting and insightful broadcasts.
Or is it you've seen? But you have no right to call me a murderer. You have a right to kill me. You have a right to do that. But you have no right to judge me. It's impossible through words to describe what is necessary to those who do not know what horror means. Horror. Horror has a face. And you must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends. If they are not, then they are enemies to be feared. They are truly enemies. I remember when I was with Special Forces. Seems a thousand centuries ago. We went into a camp to inoculate some children. We left the camp after we had inoculated the children for polio. And this old man came running after us and he was crying. He couldn't say. We went back there, and they had come and hacked off every inoculated arm. There they were in a pile of little arms. And I remember, I cried, I wept like some grandmother. I wanted to tear my teeth out. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I want to remember it. I never want to forget it. I never want to forget. And then I realized, like I was shot with a diamond. A diamond bullet right through my forehead. And I thought, my God, the genius of that. The genius. The will to do that. Perfect, genuine, complete, crystalline, pure. And then I realized they were stronger than we because they could stand it. These were not monsters. These were men, trained cadres. These men who fought with their hearts, who have families, who have children, who are filled with love. But they had the strength to do that. If I had 10 divisions of those men, then our troubles here would be over very quickly. You have to have men who are moral, and at the same time, who are able to utilize their primordial instincts to kill without feeling, without passion, without judgment,